From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the North Clinton section of the city of Rochester. That's the epicenter of Rochester's growing heroin problem. You might have seen the recent reporting by Adam Chodak on WROC-TV focusing on that part of the city and the debate over what to do next. When it comes to heroin, some advocate for free needles, needle exchanges. Others argue that the needles end up used, tossed on neighborhood streets, a major public health problem. And what about safe spaces for users, as we've seen proposed in places like Ithaca? What's the best way to help people whose lives are at risk? There is a lot to discuss here, so let me welcome my guests for the hour. Adam Chodak is an anchor for WROC-TV. Nice to have you back here.
A pleasure to be here.
Also here is Matt Woodring, Woody, as he's known, is a kind of an advocate now and a former addict, and we're going to talk about his story and the work that he's doing. Woody, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Miguel Melendez is here, Special Projects Director for Ibero-American Development Corporation. Miguel, welcome to you as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You know, Adam, you had a couple of stories, and we'll link to those on our Twitter accounts for people to check out here in the last week or so. What turned you on to this now?
So late last year, folks might remember there was that picture that came out. Someone took a picture of a porta potty in a local park. It was open, and inside you could see all of the used heroin paraphernalia. It was pretty stunning to those who are not familiar with the problem. And I thought I was familiar with the problem. I was not. I was as stunned as anyone. We went out there. We didn't know much about
it. You mean you thought it was bad, but
exactly.
Maybe the scale of it?
We knew through headlines that the epidemic was growing, and we were not avoiding that here. And so we went to the area where this was, and then upon a little research, we found out that this particular area has been targeted by the city in recent initiatives, things like that. And then Matt Woodring, Woody, reached out to me and said, you know, you may want to investigate this a little bit more. There are things going on in the community that you should probably know about. The situation is very grave. And he gave me a wonderful insight into that area. And that was what encouraged me to then move forward to do two pieces, one looking at how this is an epicenter. It's drawing people in from all over the suburbs, various counties, and I'm sure we'll go over why. And then the second piece talked about the needle exchange program and the various steps the city is taking to try to reduce the problem there.
I thought it was outstanding reporting, a wide range of voices in that. And I want to make clear this hour, you know, not everybody that Adam talks to in these pieces agrees on what to do. And that's okay. Everyone is approaching this with the best intentions. Everybody wants people to be clean, neighborhoods to be clean, neighborhoods to be strong. There is some disagreement on how to get there. We will work through that. But I think at least there's mutual respect. Didn't you find that?
I think at the very base of everything, like you said, best intentions and a common understanding that addicts are suffering from a disease. Everyone I spoke with, whether it was the police officer, whether it was the mayor, Woody, Miguel, folks at Trillium Health, everyone understood that this is a disease. No one attached a stigma to it. No one belittled the addicts. And I found that to be very interesting, very refreshing, and provided some common ground.
By the way, Miguel, you're nodding right away with that. Why don't you elaborate on some of your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. We know that many folks struggle with this. So, you know, we're on the ground in the neighborhood often, and we hear from residents that, you know, some of the things they see, some things horrify them, but they definitely understand that this is something that clearly is not controllable to some degree. When someone is in a tough state and they need to use, they need to use. And it doesn't matter if it's in public view or behind a brick wall somewhere. So we're certainly compassionate in that regard.
Okay. And listeners, if you want to call with questions or comments, maybe your own experiences or concerns about the heroin epidemic in Rochester and in our area, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Woody, I want to start with a question for you based on a conversation I recently had with a guy who's become kind of this traveling journalist who he goes all over the country, mostly to communities that are really struggling, where factories have closed, where jobs are gone, finds a lot of drug use. And we're talking places like parts of Rochester, but also the Rust Belt, rural America, a lot of drugs, a lot of heroin. But what bothers him the most is when people, for example, he recently attacked Bill Maher. He said Bill Maher on HBO likes to poke fun at quote-unquote Trump voters who are heroin users. And this reporter, Chris Arnotti, said to me, look, most often, heroin or drugs is where you go when you feel like you've got nothing left. You don't have a job. You don't often have hope. I wonder how you feel about that, Woody.
For me, that was not my experience.
Okay. All right.
You know, my use began a very long time ago, probably just out of high school. And for me, I was working a full-time job, had a very functional life.
In Rochester?
Right here in Rochester. I grew up in Pittsburgh. Lived there my whole life. And so in my early 20s, I was, you know, very involved in the bar scene. I was partying. I would work all day and party all night. And as my drug use developed and as it grew, I continued to experiment with new things. And for me, the heroin use stemmed exclusively from the pills. I started with Vicodin, and you know, a pill never scared me. Years and years and years ago, I would have told you I will never use heroin. I will never stick a needle in my arm. I will never live homeless. I will never go to jail. Today, all of those things are true about me. But it began with taking a simple pill. And to me, in my mind at the time, I didn't see anything wrong with that.
You did that recreationally?
I did it recreationally. Okay. Yep. You know, it began with a friend who had gotten hurt or somehow came across the prescription of Vicodin, and it ended up in my hands. I paid him for it, whatever. And I liked what it did to me. I really liked what it did to me. It made me feel like $1 million. And I think that that is something that often gets lost on people, is that there is a real euphoria that comes with drug use. For me, I continued to use drugs because I liked what they did to me. I like how they made me feel. They were very accepted in my social circles.
Okay. Did you crash then, by the way? You would have this euphoria, but then the next day, the next morning, do you crash or are you not?
Not at first.
Okay.
At first, when my use was very minimal and I was taking small amounts, I would wake up and maybe be a little tired, but I was using very small amounts of a low-dose opiate,
yeah,
you know, being Vicodin, Percocet, codeine.
And you know you wanted more, right?
And so the next day would roll around, or 2 days later would roll around, and because I was using these low doses, there was very little consequences, both physically and externally. You know, it didn't affect my job. It didn't affect my life in any way, shape, or form, other than the fact that it enhanced my social life.
So how did that go off the rails then?
Well, you know, as an addict and alcoholic, I believe that that is just something that is in me. And because I liked what it did so much, I continued to seek out more of it. And as years went by, I mean, because I was a very functional addict for a long time. It was probably a good 5 or 6 years before the people who were around me that I wasn't making privy to this information even started to notice. I would make it to work every day. I would do a great job, and I would go out at night, and I would, you know, go to the bars or go to house parties, but I'd still be to work the next day. My bills were still getting paid. I wasn't crashing my car and getting—
And you were on heroin at the time, right?
I was not on heroin.
Okay.
I was still on Vicodin.
So when did you make that switch?
Well, it went on, and it was a very slow progression, but I ate my first Vicodin pill when I was 19 years old in 1999. By the time I was 27 years old, I was eating 150 10-milligram Vicodins a day. I would wake up and eat 10 or 15 of them, and that would go every 2 or 3 hours, 7 a.m., 9 a.m., noon, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, dinner, you know, after dinner, after work, and it would just— – that was a daily thing. So as that continued to progress, my body became very physically dependent.
What do you spend— – what's 150 pills a day cost?
150 pills a day, that street value, you're looking at anywhere from $300 to $500 a day.
A day?
Yeah.
Where are you getting the money for that?
Well, often in those circles, drug users buy and sell drugs from each other. Things like that aren't hard to get, but they also— – you can't just walk into Wegmans and say, I'm ready for another 200.
Yeah, sure, right.
So oftentimes, my friends and I were selling drugs to each other. And, you know, and I was working a job. So in addition to having my job, the addiction fueled itself for a long time until it hit that point where it paid for itself until it didn't.
Okay.
And that was kind of really when a lot of the consequences started to come up. You know, I stopped paying my rent. I started robbing my friends. I would tell a friend, oh, sure, I'll get you 100 Vicodins and take his $300. And then I'd come back to him a day later with some story that was a lie because I needed the drugs. So I would do whatever I had to do, whether it was robbing my friends and family or lying to the people around me. I would tell close friends I need to borrow some money to pay my rent, and I wasn't even paying my rent. Very quickly, in that last couple years, I lost a job that I worked for a long time. I was evicted from an apartment, and after that happened, it wasn't a year before I was in jail on a felony burglary charge. You know, I was homeless. I had
but
lost.
But you still weren't on heroin?
No, I still wasn't on heroin.
I'm just trying to figure out, when did heroin hit?
Right after that.
Okay.
Right after that. A big thing that happened was I went to jail for the first time in 2008, I think, maybe 2008. Yeah, it was November 9th of 2008. And I spent 2 months in there. And when I got out, there was no treatment. I was waiting on... I was waiting on the law process, and so I wasn't sentenced to anything. I was waiting for court dates, and I was just kind of being held on a large bail, and I had burned enough bridges. My family was not looking to let me back into that lifestyle. So they determined, you know, my family decided it was probably best to just leave me where I was. They knew I was safe. So from there, I was put into Rochester Drug Treatment Court, and I had my first experience with 12-step programs. I got sent into an outpatient rehab program. I wasn't personally interested. What I was interested in was removing the consequences. I didn't want to go to prison, and which is a different thing than county jail. I was not looking to go and spend 3 or 5 or 7 years in prison. So I started into these programs where I started to meet more addicts like me, and a good friend of mine who I had known for a long time, and our addictions kind of progressed together, started to tell me, well, you know, you're spending all this money on Vicodin, and for $10 you can get the same effect out of a bag of heroin. And that was when I switched to heroin and started using needles. From there, I went on for another 10 years.
10 years on heroin?
10 years on heroin.
Wow.
It was kind of on and off. I spent that year, I did a back and forth with drug court. It's a 1 year program. To graduate drug court, the requirement is to have a year of continuous sobriety, to complete a drug treatment program, and to either be in school or working or somehow being a productive member of society. And I kind of did this. I would try to go and lie to the judge, and I would, you know, try to use on Friday so that I could still be clean on Monday when I would go in for a drug screen. And that just, it never worked. And I got to this point where I was told by the judge that this is your last chance. You mess up one more time, and I'm sending you to prison. So I managed to stay clean for a year so that I could get those consequences away. But as soon as that happened, I went right back to the heroin.
Because you were still focused on just avoiding prison as opposed to really getting clean.
Yeah, I was not interested in getting clean. I was interested in getting rid of what we often call in 12-step programs as a back problem. I had people on my back. So I wanted you off my back. I wanted Judge Johnson off my back.
Yeah, gotcha.
I wanted Connor for counseling off my back. So I did what I had to do. And it was like a little deal I made with myself that when I remove these consequences, I'm going to go back to what I want to be doing.
And so, all right. So let me just read something real quick here. And because what Woody is describing is, you know, his years of addiction. Could you have quit for good if you wanted to, by the way, Woody?
If I had wanted to, I suppose I could have. I mean, when I wanted to, I did quit.
Okay.
You know, which is where I am today.
Okay. But let me just read this real quickly, because as I mentioned, Chris Arnotti, the journalist, meets a lot of people, and his experience is, especially in rural areas, you lose hope, there's no jobs, it feels like a dead end, and you end up in drugs. And he's cautioning us not to judge people in that situation. Then you might have seen the second a show on WXXI TV. We produced Second Opinion. And Second Opinion did a show in which they interviewed Cynthia Scudo, who's a grandmother of 20, who shared her story of hip pain that ended up with a 9-year addiction to heroin. And as Second Opinion reported, experts say the heroin epidemic is largely spurred by people who first become addicted to prescribed opiate pain medications. The pills become more expensive, harder to get, and what do? They find something cheaper and more potent, heroin. So you weren't on pain medication for an injury or a problem.
No,
but,
sir.
But it's largely the same.
Yes,
that you're looking for something cheaper. You're tired of being addicted to something that you need more and more of. You go to heroin.
Yeah.
And so help me see what finally got you off. I want to grab a couple of phone calls in a second, but what finally got you off, Woody, to finally walk away from heroin?
Well, I finished that drug court program in 2011, and I ended up spending the next 10, well, eight or so years on and off of heroin. I eventually became homeless, and I spent 2 years living outside. And I was one of those guys that you see standing at the highway holding up the cardboard sign. I would walk up and down Monroe Ave and pick up cans and bottles and beg for change and do whatever I had to do. And especially towards the end, I was so focused on just feeding that addiction, just fueling the monster, that I would do everything I could to keep the police kind of stay away from their radar. I would do my best not to terrorize society. And I had learned that lesson the hard way. I just kept going with it until I was just so worn down. I was emotionally empty. I was alone. I was spiritually bankrupt. And I got to a point where I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, as they often say in 12-step programs. Mm-hmm. And when it was time, when I was ready, and I was really ready to accept help, I was able to seek out that help. The drug court program that I had done, that was probably the greatest gift I got, was that it exposed me to sobriety. I wasn't ready for it at the time, but I was able to learn about it, and I knew exactly where to go and who to ask for help and how to go about getting that help.
All right, so let me close the loop on your story before we kind of turn the conversation here. Today, do you feel any craving? Is it difficult to be clean?
It's not easy, but I wouldn't say that it's difficult.
Okay.
There is a lot of work that I have to put into my sobriety, and it is daily work. Some days are easier than others. But when I maintain all of the things that I do that keep me sober, it's not terribly difficult. It's just a lot of work.
Now, Woody's got some ideas on what we do next. I know Miguel does as well. And if you saw Adam Chodak's story, his stories on WROC TV over the last week, you've seen that those kind of conversations. I want to get into that, and we'll start with a phone call. Samantha in Pittsford has her own story and some comments about a needle exchange program. So go ahead, Samantha.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I just wanted to call in real quick. My story is real long. I'll just make it really short here. I sniffed my first bag of heroin when I was 14 years old. And after that one time, I started IV injection. I had older friends. I was in partying a lot. And he touched on some of the comments where people sort of forget this euphoria that you get from it. So, you know, I'm partying and, you know, everybody knows me. We're all having a good time. And then I go too far because I'm the addict, and they're not having enough fun for me anymore. So I go out on my own. I was born in Canandaigua, and I moved quickly to Rochester as soon as I could get a car. I moved to Rochester. I had that car for a couple weeks before I sold it. And I lived homeless on Avenue D, Clinton, Lyle. I was homeless for about 6 years. I lived in abandoned houses. I slept outside. It's, you know, the horror story is very real. But what I wanted to say is the needle exchange program is something that I didn't have the extra, you know, $2 to eat. I surely didn't have the extra $2 to buy a bag of needles, which, by the way, you can just, most pharmacies you can walk into with just your ID saying that you're 18 and you can get a bag of hypodermic needles. So, but I didn't have that money. I didn't have, you know, clean needles. I didn't have a place to shower. The needle exchange program, as much as, you know, people think that it's sort of fueling this fire of they're getting clean needles, we're just sort of enabling them. It was really, it probably has prevented me from catching a lifelong illness, like AIDS or Hep C. And they give you lunches there. I mean, it's you don't just take it and you're like, hey, this is a great life, you know, but you do it, and you do it sort of with a lot of shame, but it keeps you alive for the moment, you know, their lunch and their clean shower.
And are you clean now, Samantha?
I am. I was clean. I was clean for 3 years. That's the longest I've ever had, was 3 years. And this recent summer, I did relapse for about a month, but I've been clean since August again. So I'll get back to my 3 years, and I'll get back up there. But I'm always really interested to see what the next step is. You know, people are condoning these supervised injection sites.
Well, and Samantha, let me just jump in and say, you've given us a great opening to talk about something that Adam reported on just this week. Good luck to you. Good luck to you. I'm glad to hear you're clean, and continued success for you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot.
That's Samantha in Pittsford. Adam, she's talking about a number of issues, but let's turn to needle exchange, which she's talking about. First of all, why don't you describe that situation as you're reporting told, you know, your audience, tell our listeners about that, and then we'll have our panelists also talk about, you know, their thoughts on what's going on there.
Yeah, so if we could, we can start with geography here. So what we're talking about is North Clinton Avenue, which is just north of downtown Rochester. And as you go north, you're going to have Central Avenue as a cross street, and that is where Trillium Health's center is, their needle exchange program. And that's where people can go. That's what Samantha was talking about. From what I understand, it's the only needle exchange program in our area. So you have people coming in from Wayne County, Ontario County. And then as you continue north, that's when you really hit the main North Clinton Avenue neighborhood, where you get into Scranton Street and things like that. And so, and I know Miguel's can go into better detail than I, but really what you have is a congregation of users, and it is a very, very messy situation. You do go into parks, you see the used needles, you see the caps, you see the baggies. We got photos of that and video of that. And it turns up in people's yards.
It wasn't hard to find, was it?
Playgrounds, it's everywhere. So it's a very unfortunate situation for the users and the neighbors. And it's been like that, and Miguel, again, can go into better detail, for years. So it's not necessarily even like a chicken and the egg. Like, Trillium came in because there was a problem there.
All right,
and
so
it's
tell
only
us
grown.
Tell us what Trillium decided to do then.
So Trillium Health, by the way, they believe in what's called harm reduction, which that is their top priority, which is they basically talk about what Samantha was talking about, which is we are going to help the addict. We are going to try and prevent disease, HIV, Hep C, the best we can, so they're healthy when they're ready for treatment. And that is their main priority when it comes to
keep them alive,
this particular area. Yeah. So they not only had the needle exchange program in its base location on Central Avenue, they also created a mobile unit that would actually go around and then hand out the needles. And where some of the controversy comes in is whether they were taking old needles, because the word exchange would imply that they are taking in old needles, so they're not on the ground, and they're giving out clean new ones for the users.
Okay, Miguel, I know there are some folks who had some problems with that one. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly needle exchange programs, when it comes to public health and reducing, you know, HIV and Hep C, it has its place. One of the challenges in the harm reduction model is harm transference. I think that when you have excess of needles getting out in the community and there's not a one-for-one model where, you know, if I'm giving a needle, I'm getting one back, we have this problem, which is the needles end up on the ground. I think when individuals are using, they're not necessarily thinking about where the needle should go. And, you know, education around that, I think, can be a critical part of how we move forward. But what ends up happening is we have business owners and residents who come home to either something sticking out of a tree lawn in front of their house or, you know, a congregation of needles around a dumpster of a business. And it's frustrating for the resident who lives there. You know, certainly they're compassionate, but there's only so much this neighborhood can take. Most of the folks who are using are not from the area. So to some degree, it becomes an issue of, are we victimizing this neighborhood? And my opinion is, to some degree, we are.
Okay, so what I want to do is, real briefly here, because I know Woody's going to want to respond to that, but I also want to let Miguel respond to Julie Ritzler. This is a clip from WROC-TV's reporting, because Trillium didn't have anyone available to join the conversation today. So this is Julie Ritzler from Trillium responding to this very idea.
I think that's the perception. I don't think that's the reality. The truck has been off the street now for over a year, and we've seen an incredible increase in discarded syringes, in people going to the area and using drugs in the area.
So she's saying that, you know, even with the truck gone, you've got the same problem. Do you disagree, Miguel?
I don't disagree with the truck being gone. You know, has the problem gotten worse? It has become gradually worse nationally over time. I think that the truck, for the residents' perspective, whether right or wrong, right, the residents felt that it was enabling the activity to be centralized. The drug market was there. The needle was right across the street. You had a one-stop shop for everything you need to use. And so from that perspective, you know, setting new standards for this community moving forward, residents really weren't fond of the truck visiting that particular location in the middle of the drug market.
Okay, and Samantha called back in just to say, in her case, the needle exchange program is a one-for-one. You get seven, and you bring seven back dirty. The needles in the park that Miguel's talking about, Samantha says, are needles that were purchased from a pharmacy. Is that not your experience?
No, not, it is not.
Okay, what do you think?
You know, I spent a lot of time in the North Clinton neighborhood, and I think Miguel just hit the nail on the head. And the reason I believe that all of this is centered around North Clinton is because that's where the drug market is located. And I have said 1,000 times, if I could have bought my drugs in Pittsford, I never would have gone to North Clinton Avenue. But all of the heroin, the lion's share of the heroin that is sold in this city is sold up and down North Clinton Avenue. You know, in my time as an addict, I used in that porta potty that Adam was talking about. I've been guilty of throwing needles in there. The syringe exchange program that Trillium has, they encourage a one-for-one exchange, but they
don't require it?
They don't require it per se. They are not going to tell an addict, and I don't believe that they should, if you don't bring me a needle, I'm not going to give you a clean one.
So are you in favor of this offering addicts needles in this way?
I am. You know, I believe that they do encourage a one-for-one exchange. But again, I think the larger issue is to keep the use safe. They have a pamphlet that has the picture of a reused needle having been used once, twice, five times, 10 times. And by the end, I see Miguel nodding over here. It looks like a fish hook. It's got barbs coming over all over the place. And, you know, the issue at hand, I believe, is the fact that the heroin market is located on North Clinton Avenue. You could remove the syringe exchange from the equation, and there will still be needles all over Clinton Avenue.
Because that's where the market is.
That's where the heroin is.
Yeah.
You know, as well as the cocaine, you know, for me at the end, I combine the heroin and the cocaine, and that's where the drugs are. So you know, when I would go up there and I would be what we call dope sick, physically withdrawing from the opiates. And when I was in that place as an addict, my number one priority, it was just like breathing. Like I had to get what I needed to get in my body, meaning the heroin. So when I would go and buy my heroin, I was going to get it into me as soon as I could. You know, and if that meant going into the porta potty, going behind
and then leaving the needles
house
there.
On Ketchum, it was never. I did my best not to, but I'm definitely guilty of it. It happens.
Okay.
You know, there are times where someone comes around and you're trying to run. A police officer might be driving by, a neighbor, and it happens.
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to get our only break of the hour. Rochester City Councilman Michael Patterson's on the line. We're going to take his call when we come back. He represents the Northeast District, and he's got some thoughts about the needs of the community versus needs of addicts. So we'll take his call, we'll get more of your phone calls in, and we'll continue with our guest. You're hearing Woody, Matt Woodring, who is a former addict, telling his story. He's also doing a lot of advocacy work, just trying to help educate people about these issues. Miguel Melendez, Special Projects Director for the Ibero-American Development Corporation, and Adam Chodak, WROC-TV anchor. His reporting on this subject is what sparked these discussions. Let's go ahead and get that break and come right back to your calls. Coming up in our second hour, what is a CSA? Maybe you know that it means community-supported agriculture. Maybe you belong to a CSA. But there's a debate about what it does mean and what it does not mean, and whether the term has been co-opted by businesses that see a profit incentive. In that case, a lot of small farms feel like they're getting left out and they're losing customers. We'll talk about that issue next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me state the obvious here. We could probably talk about heroin, the opioid epidemic, every day for both hours for the next 6 months. I mean, the problem is remarkable. The individual stories are heartbreaking. It is real. And as Adam Chodak said earlier this hour, it's easy to think that you know. But it is a humongous problem nationwide. Adam, I hope that both you and I, Megan Mac producer, we can all tweet your stories that you've done. So we'll put fresh tweets out this afternoon. So if you want to check out his reporting from WROC-TV, we can do that. So we'll do that this afternoon.
Absolutely. That would be great.
Okay. And let me grab a phone call. Councilman Patterson's on the line with us. Go ahead, Councilman.
Thank you. Look, I'm glad you guys have Miguel there. And I apologize for not hearing about this earlier and listening to the whole thing. You know, look, I am not opposed to harm reduction. Everybody gets harm reduction, and we're all in favor of it. And the gentleman who said earlier, hey, whatever's going on, this is where the heroin market is, you're going to have these needles, there's definitely a truth to that. But at the same time, this is government giving out the needles. Let's be clear about who's passing out the needles. It's government funded, it's government work. So if you're going to own harm reduction on one side, looking out for the addicts, and I am certainly in favor of looking out for the addicts. I've had plenty of IV drug users in my family, and I grew up with them. So there's no hatred for anybody. I understand. I don't know your pain, but I've seen it growing up, and I got nothing but love for y'all. So that's not the issue. That's not the problem. But at the same time, the safety of the people who live in the neighborhood who don't use drugs has to be taken into consideration. And if you're going to spend the money to pass out the needles, you have an obligation to spend the money to get somebody out there to pick up the needles in an expeditious manner. And that's the problem we're running into. And until we start owning it, the problem on both sides, it's harm transference. And so the question becomes, why is it that the people in North Clinton Avenue are seen as less? Why is it acceptable for these needles to be out here? Now, the city of Rochester is doing the best it can do. But, you know, we don't fund needle distribution. State government does.
Councilman, let me just ask you a couple quick questions. Would you be more comfortable if, for example, the Trillium model changed to a requirement of a one-for-one? In other words, they don't hand out a needle without getting at least one back.
I would love that, but I'm going to tell you, I'm going to make it easier for you than that. If the needles go out, somebody's got to go out there and get them all. And I'm not real picky about who gets them all, and I'm not real picky about who pays for them. My thought is, hey, if you're going to pay to buy the needles, then you have an obligation to pay to go get the needles picked up and cleaned up. Now, whatever mechanism you want to follow to do that,
okay,
I'm on board with it.
Okay.
I'm easy.
Okay. And the other question I had for you then, Councilman, is I suspect you have seen the news out of Ithaca. The mayor there, Svantri Myrick, who's someone who we've tried to get on this program, and we will get him eventually. You know, he has advocated for not just needle exchange, but safe space and essentially access rooms, a room for someone who is an addict to know that they can go and safely use, that if they're going to use, that they can do it safely until they are ready, as Woody has kind of described, ready in that moment in their life to get clean. That's obviously been controversial, and we hope to talk to the mayor of Ithaca about that. How do you feel about that?
Well, so the question then becomes, if you want to have that conversation, let's have a regional conversation about that. Because the folks that are using in the North Clinton drug market don't live in the North Clinton drug market. So if you want to open those up in Pittsford and Brighton and Penfield and Danville and everywhere else, and then you want to talk about doing it in the city of Rochester, let's have that regional conversation. But something tells me that nobody wants to hear that. Because right now, it impacts my constituents. So since it's only my constituents getting hammered and hurt by this, it seems as though other than the folks here in the city of Rochester, this is our problem. Well, it's not our problem. It's a regional problem.
Yeah.
And until we're going to own it as a region, then, you know, when we decide we're going to do that, then we can have that conversation. But we ain't there yet, because right now everybody wants to just see it as a city North Clinton Avenue problem, and it's not.
Councilman, thanks for calling the program, and I hope to talk to you again on this and many other issues.
Thank you.
Councilman Michael Patterson from the city of Rochester. And by the way, you heard Woody say earlier, I mean, he grew up in Pittsford and would go and use in the city. Miguel and Adam Chodak's reporting both indicated, so the councilman, we don't have to waste too much time on this, hours going quickly, but the councilman's right. A lot of the people who come into those neighborhoods are not living in those neighborhoods. Miguel, fair, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And I mean, go ahead.
70% of the vehicle traffic in the last 3.5 years that the police department did, field information forms, came from outside of the city.
All right, short response to what you heard from the councilman, Woody. Go ahead, then I'll get back on the phones.
Short response, I will say that I know for a fact that the 4 employees that Trillium has at the needle exchange goes out several times a week to pick up needles. And the issue at hand is there's just too many of them. They can only go to so many sites at a time, but I know that from firsthand experience. And lastly, I would just say that the comment about the North Clinton residents being the ones that are being hurt, I would just propose to also consider that those are the same residents that are the ones who are selling the drugs.
Can I respond to
Miguel?
That? Most of the folks who are selling the drugs also don't live in that community. So you have people who are coming in to buy the drugs, but then also people coming in to sell the drugs. And they're not too far away sometimes. You have some folks that are local, but for the most part, they're moving into a house that a landlord doesn't care about to be able to offer this as a service.
Okay. So so let me get back to your phone calls. And on the question of, you know, finding needles, what to do about it, Caroline in Rochester wants to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Caroline.
Yes. So I walked out of my front door one day and saw a bunch of needles on the sidewalk, walked around my neighbor's garage, saw a bunch more, called the police department 3 times, called 911. No one ever showed up. I eventually ended up going to my local police department, which was on Norton, asking them what I should do. They suggested I call Trillium Health. I had never heard of Trillium Health before. Suggested that I actually take the needles there, like I'm going to touch them. The lack of the response from the police department was just deplorable. I was shocked that they were not willing to help me or send me in the right direction. As you know, I expected if I find needles on the ground and I call the police department that they should show up. Apparently that is not the case. I also drive down Clinton Avenue every day to work. I see policemen sitting there doing absolutely nothing, while 2 blocks down, I see a drug activity. So I guess what my frustration is with the local police department, that there's no response whatsoever to this problem. And I couldn't agree with Patterson more. You're putting an addict's desire for drugs over my need as a taxpayer living in that neighborhood, and that's extremely frustrating.
So, Caroline, can I just ask you one quick question then?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't have anybody from RPD here, and I don't want to characterize police as sitting around doing nothing. I understand the point. You know, sometimes you see officers, doesn't look like they're engaged in anything. But do you feel that you know, at the very least, the baseline should be when officers have downtime, they are actively looking to clean up needles. I mean, is that...
How about get out of your car and walk down the street?
But to be fair, some officers do that, don't they?
Never. I've never seen that happen on Clinton Avenue, and I drive that every day to and from work. I have not seen one policeman out of their car.
Okay. Caroline, thank you for the phone call. Woody, you're saying you have.
I have.
Miguel, you have. Yeah. Adam Chodak, you want to weigh in there, too? Go ahead.
Yeah, so in the piece, the first one and the second one, we interviewed Officer Eric Majewicz, who is helping to head up the task force, if you will, that's looking into this problem. And you can tell he is very engaged in the problem. And he's trying things that might be getting pushback from certain segments of government because he does want to acknowledge harm reduction along with policing. And so they have done a lot of things over the last 2 years that are very visible. They've built walls in certain areas that have been cut-throughs. So they've tried to stop that. They've cut back growth because that can hide shooting galleries where people can...
Makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it takes away some of the spots where this can happen. I know that, obviously, if you're an addict, you want privacy, you want a spot, but they're trying to board up houses. They've gotten rid of some vacant houses. They've added LED lights in certain parks. They're trying to make it a bit more open in certain areas and closed off in others so they can better monitor this problem. And as far as I can tell, they are, at least Officer Majewicz is out and about and very aware of the problem.
Okay. Dan in Brighton on the phone. Next up. Go ahead, Dan.
I think the whole drug problem would be solved if you just legalized them and treated addicts. Portugal legalized drugs and has no problem. Uruguay has semi-legalized drugs and has no problem. If I were the Mexican government, since Trump is defecating all over the Mexican government and people...
Let me just jump in there, Dan, cut you off a little bit there. I think we got the gist of what you're saying. You think legalization is going to help, and I hear that argument. I would just say, whether it's legalization or less criminalization of usage, you know, the idea of harm reduction is kind of part and parcel with less criminalization. You still have medical issue. You still have, I mean, it is a very much a medical issue for people who are addicted, right, Woody?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the idea is the same across the board, is that the largest thing that would help would be to get it out of the closet. You know, all of these issues we're describing, these cuts in between the buildings, it's where, as addicts, we will go and hide. You know, a lot of the stigma that we often talk about is lack of education and misunderstanding. And I think in a lot of issues, in a lot of cases, if people, meaning addicts and users, were not trying to hide the drugs, were not trying to hide the behaviors, you could nip a lot of these cases in the bud before they got to the point where people are homeless and living on the streets and overdosing and dying.
Okay. Miguel, how do you feel about Dan's comment?
Well, I think that, you know, I really want to say that we're painting a grim picture here, and I know that heroin can look really messy, and in this community it does. But this community is a beautiful community. I don't want to lose that in this conversation.
Amen.
And there's a lot of people who are compassionate, who care, and who are working hard to change some of these dynamics in the area. So we see a different neighborhood than this, and that's what we're all working on.
Here's an email from a listener named John, who says, Evan, it's time for these addicts to take personal responsibility. There's too much coddling. Try building more jails with no frills. Frills in jail. Woody, did you find a lot of frills in jail?
Not in my experience.
Yeah,
no.
I mean, that's what you probably email when you've never seen a jail, John. You know, frills in jail. And he also says, i.e. Tent City. Yeah, because the only heroin problem is in Rochester, right? John, we have a heroin problem in Yates County. We have a heroin problem in every rural county. And we have a heroin problem that is really serious in the Rust Belt, in hollowed out communities that largely voted for Donald Trump. This is not Donald Trump's fault, by the way. I'm saying this is not just about Rochester. Adam Chodak's reporting looked at Rochester's epicenter. But this notion that take frills out of jail, take responsibility, what he said, eventually you got to choose it. You got to want to be accountable. But, you know, that's the kind of email when you've really never been
for
in the
me,
jail or met a heroin addict.
It didn't take very long before I was to the point where jail didn't scare me. And I could have gone in and out of jail forever.
And it's not because of the frills.
About the frills or lack thereof. It just didn't scare me. There is a common saying among addicts, you want to play, you got to pay. And it's, you know, I mean, you oftentimes see addicts get themselves arrested to get out of the cold for the winter.
All right, let me go to Pittsburgh. This is Jenna. Hi, Jenna, go ahead.
Hi, real quick. I have two friends who've been deeply impacted by heroin. One's daughter died, but she didn't die because she went to Clinton Avenue to get her heroin. She died because the dealer came to her, delivered the heroin to her living room while her mother was asleep upstairs. And I think the difference with this addiction than alcoholism and other addictions is if you're an alcoholic, one more drink isn't going to kill you. But one bag of heroin absolutely can. And I think that's a really, really important distinction. The second is that trying to get help in today's world maze of health insurance is so almost impossible that that's where the mayor of Ithaca is trying to create a system that makes serious change and serious effort. My second friend, who was a very popular local radio personality in town in Pittsburgh, her daughter became addicted. That was a Clinton Avenue visit. She was just written up in an article in Ohio. That's where she moved. Her parents took her there to try and get her away from the drugs. It didn't work. And until her baby was born addicted to the drugs. And she was put in a very special program in that state, and she's turned her life around. This is impacting multiple generations, and I think you're all doing phenomenal reporting, but we've all got to change our perspective and end the stigma of this addiction of heroin.
Yeah. Thank you, Jenna. Thanks. I mean, that's it's hard to argue with. I mean, Miguel and Woody opened the hour with similar comments on that and talked about how far that would go. But before we lose the hour, and I hope we all remember Jenna's call. That's very important. Mike and Avon wanted to call in and say that he thinks that Woody's comments about Vicodin were kind of demonizing prescription drugs. And he says there are people that really need them. There's no doubt there are people that really need them, but there's also no doubt that we've overprescribed them and that if you go back 25 years, one of the best things this country ever could have done is not go down the opioid road quite as strongly. Because in the early days, the study showed it would be less than 1% addicted, and it's more than 10%. They were wrong about those things. Woody, did you feel like you were demonizing opioids or people with legitimate pain?
I know, and I think that people with legitimate pain should be on them, but I think that the overprescription is a major issue. I think that they're too widely available. They're too easy to get. Also, more often than not, there are families that have them in the medicine cabinet, and mom and dad don't even know what's in their medicine cabinet. Mm. And that's how it started with me. You know, the kids take them. And if it's not the kids, it's the kids' friends. Or if it's their friends. And even if it's not being taken for personal use, it's getting taken to sell to their other friends. It's... they're just too widely available.
Okay, we're down to our last 90 seconds, so maybe 30 seconds, Miguel. What do you want to see happen next on this issue in Rochester?
Well, I think we need to continue the conversation, and from my perspective, we really need to focus in on the areas where these markets exist as well and think about the neighborhoods and how we can minimize the impact of both drug use and focus on sales.
Okay, Adam Chodak, in your reporting now, I mean, no reporting on this issue, unfortunately, is ever done, but what are the big questions in your mind going forward?
I'd like to see the results. So the mayor has set aside resources to try and get people to the table and address some of these issues, and only time will tell, and we're going to keep our eye on that. Lastly, I'd like to echo Miguel's comments that people should go visit the North Clinton Ave neighborhood. It's awesome. I took him up on his suggestion to eat at LP Loan.
Oh,
I think.
You know what?
Oh, boy.
I know.
What
Megan and I haven't been there yet. We keep hearing.
What a treat.
That's next.
$5, best meal in a month.
Yeah, no, thank you for the reminder on LP Loan, by the way. And Miguel, thank you for that. As we get ready to wrap here, I would just mention that yesterday afternoon I tweeted a link to an article in Commentary Magazine looking at the state of the American economy since the year 2000. And part of that article looked at joblessness across the country, not just the unemployment rate, but the workforce participation rate. And there's some real trouble. It also looked at opioid addiction. And it looked at how, for some people, you go, well, you know, you're out of a job. You're living in a community with no work. How are you able to sustain this opioid habit? In some cases, Medicaid will pay, you got to pay a $3 copay, and you can still get taxpayers to pay for pills.
And you don't even have to pay it.
So, and I'm not demonizing doctors not all doctors, I mean, most doctors I've ever met are fabulous, but there are doctors who don't really work that hard to check, and all of a sudden, especially in these rural communities, a $3 copay, the government pays the rest, they get the money, you get the pills. There are certain policies that have to be examined here. It's complex, but Woody, I just want to say good luck to you.
Thank you.
And thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks
I know
for
you're working
me.
Hard on this. Miguel, I know you're working hard as well. Everybody wants to see better results and solutions here. Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you.
And Adam Chodak's reporting is what brought us to the table here together. Again, we'll link to the pieces, but great work on that, and thanks for coming in, my friend.
Oh, it's always my pleasure.
All right, let's take a short break and more Connections next.